Welcome to the RSP Cast. I'm Matt Waldman with the Rookie Scouting Portfolio. I want to thank everyone for just the tremendous feedback that you've given for the 2019 Rookie Scouting Portfolio publication that was made available for download April 1st. If you haven't gotten it yet, it is available at mattwaldman.com. You can purchase it there via PayPal. You'll provide a login and password, and then you log back into mattwaldman.com once you've made your purchase, and you will see a link for you to download the PDF. It's completely bookmarked pretty much to every possible heading or title that's going to be of any type of bearing that you want to read, and pretty well organized. It was something that, I had a reader this week who is legally blind tell me that he found the RSP very user-friendly, to the point that he was able to use some software and some apps to read the RSP to him. And he said that the RSP was set up in a very good way for that to work seamlessly. So if you know anybody who's visually impaired, who's a football fan, draftnik, fantasy player, who might find this useful, and sometimes they have difficulty finding good reading material that's going to be helpful in that regard, email me at mattwaldmanrsp@gmail.com, and I can provide you or them details about the apps that this particular reader used or customer used to really have success with getting a chance to listen to the RSP. So pretty awesome stuff right there. Today, what we're going to listen to, what we're going to do today with this particular podcast is we're going to talk about some questions that my editorial staff had that I thought would apply well to discussion about really things that I think you guys would be interested in, as well as talk about players who have, I think, are underachievers at this stage, who, if they can address some things in their game could really take off, as well as some running backs who I think are really below the radar at this point of draft season, who, while may not have been ranked super high on my board, I think that they offer some intrigue that if they fix a couple of things, their value could really take a nice bump upward, and they could be factors in the training camp. So let's talk about the first question, or really kind of piece of feedback that came back from one of my editors, and that was that I should talk about what I wrote in my Hakeem Butler profile when it comes to why there's variation among the wide receiver class. Why is it that, there's so much variation in grades between what draft analysts have to say, what teams do, and why that is, and why that's that way pretty much every year. So to begin with, you have to understand that the NFL scouting process, the way the wide receiver position works, and the way that independent scouts look at or evaluate receivers can be very different. And I think the more you learn to understand the context of rankings with, between independent scouts, media, and the league, and the differences with them, the more you'll look at draft day and not be wondering why, someone like Equanimeous St. Brown's drafted in the fifth, sixth, or seventh round as when he was ranked in the top five by Mike Mayock last year. It's not always simply about, oh, Mike Mayock was wrong, or, this team missed on a receiver and now he's really good because they had a low grade on him. I'm going to explain that now. So to begin with, you have to understand that the wide receiver position has three different roles: split end, flanker, and slot. Pretty obvious, right? We all pretty much know that. And they all each emphasize specific skills and traits over others. Split ends are going to be, tend to be the fastest players. Flankers tend to be guys who can break tackles and have really good vision, but also very good route runners, who run routes pretty much all over the field, even if not maybe the deepest ranges all the time. And then you have the slot receivers who tend to be very quick. They don't see a lot of press coverage, though, not like split ends and flankers. So the initial decision in terms of what you're looking for as a team or a scout automatically filters the wide receiver pool for you. So, for instance, scouts, when they make the initial decision of what type of receiver they're looking for, that's going to filter their pool. There's no point in for them to study 80 players that are not going to succeed in the slot if that's what their team is looking for as a slot receiver. Instead, it's better to focus on really how many slot receivers are in that pool. And if there's only 12 viable candidates, it's better to study those 12 than to try and study 80. So to complicate matters even a bit more, there's going to be teams that decide they don't just want a slot receiver. Maybe they want a slot receiver who can play a little flanker. So now they're going to filter it to players who can perform two roles. Okay. Now let's give you an example of that. Last year, Dante Pettis. The first thing that the 49ers told the media after drafting Pettis is that it coveted him because he could play multiple wide receiver roles. So some players like Pettis, he can perform all three, but there are others who maybe only can do one or two. So based on the offensive scheme and the organizational philosophy, teams are going to have preferences for specific player archetypes. Could be body type, style of movement, how that player expresses his play on the field. And all 32 teams consider a lot of these factors when they're filtering the wide receiver position pool into roles. So that's going to create different grades right there for the same player. And it's going to be for reasons beyond the fact that one scout's more skilled than the other. Okay, it's not always about that. Oftentimes it's not even remotely about that. Let's give you Pettis. Let's continue with the Pettis example to explain why, okay? So say a team's looking for a split end. Now, they may have included Pettis on their draft board because he can play split end, but the way that they value the split end position may also mean that there's a certain physical prototype that they covet, okay? So they may have looked at Pettis and said, you know what, he's not quite big enough to be the split end that we're looking for, and we're going to ding him for, you know, his dimensions, his physical dimensions. We want a stronger, bigger player. Maybe we want an even faster player than Pettis. So maybe they looked at him and said, you know what, after grading him according to what our standards are for a slot receiver, for a split end, he's our fifth ranked split end on our board. And that, and he's gets a fourth round grade. Well, you know, maybe then there's another team that looks at Pettis and decided that they, that he fits within their pool of small slot receivers, Wes Welker types. Now Pettis is a little bigger. He's not as quick. So he doesn't fit that prototype exactly well either. So maybe he's even further down a team's draft board that's looking for a small slot receiver. And now he's like seventh among the slot options, and he's getting a fifth round grade by that team. But then there's another team that may want a big slot receiver, and you look at Pettis and you go, you know what? He's actually kind of an average size receiver, so he may actually even be a candidate for our range of players that we consider, quote, big slot. Now, on the lower end of that range and kind of on the bubble of that prototype, so, you know, this team may value a bigger, stronger slot option because they want that slot option to be able to block. You know, there's going to be times that that team doesn't want to use a tight end in certain run situations that are coming from passing down sets. So they want to have some personnel flexibility, and they want to have a big slot who's going to be able to wall off or block an outside linebacker or a physical safety. And maybe Pettis, being a decent blocker, may not be good enough to be able to be manned up against an outside linebacker on a consistent basis without it being a losing proposition. So the team may have looked at that and decided, you know, Pettis is a good receiver, but as a blocker, what we really need, he's not really there for us. So maybe he's eighth on that team's board, and he has a fifth round grade for them. So when you look at it from there, you can already see, based on whether a team looks at him solely as a split end, solely as a slot receiver, solely as a big slot receiver, they might decide, you know what, he's just not measuring up to what we're looking for our prototypes, and you already have somebody who has a fourth, fifth, or sixth round grade possibly based on those types of things. But the 49ers, obviously, they picked him in the early second round. And you can kind of see the logic most likely of what happened here. They probably thought, you know what, we're looking for a flanker, but we also need a player who can also work the slot. So maybe they looked at it and narrowed their pool down to five or six players who could do both, and Pettis was on that list. And they looked at the fact that he also could play split end, and they saw that as a benefit. They liked his route running. They liked his skill after the catch. They liked his special team play. They saw his ability to win the ball in the air. And maybe they gave him a low first-round grade based on what their standards were for this particular type of player who could play multiple roles and do it well according to what they need for their scheme. So the organization, having a low first-round grade on him, thought, you know, we think Pettis is going to fall to the second round because he is, after all, a bit of a tweener among multiple receiver roles. And if we were to grade him each on a separate role in a different way, we could see how he might be third, fourth, or fifth on a list for any one of these. So we're going to take the chance and think he can fall probably the second round for us. And if he does, we'll take him. And that's exactly what happened in terms of the result. Now, the process that I kind of theorized here, that's speculation, but I think it's an educated guess based on how things work in the NFL. So this is one of the good examples why wide receiver has such great variation of draft grade among any position in football. And as you can see, most independent scouting groups, myself or anybody else that's out there, doesn't filter positions this way usually. I mean, I split out the position from, you know, to I have an overall board and then I have a slot board and a big slot board. And I do that without changing my grading formula at all for wide receiver. I just split those guys out. And so you can see where they'd rank, you know, just kind of, you can rank them yourself that way just by looking at that. Now, maybe down the line, I might decide to change the formulas a little bit for those different roles, just to give you an idea of, you know, who might rate higher or lower in that position. We'll see. It's not an immediate priority on my list, just because I think most of my audience, while I have a good bit of audience who don't play fantasy football, who are pure football on a variety of levels, you know, a big base of my audience obviously are guys like, you know, most of you listening who are fantasy players. And you're just looking for production, whether it comes from the flank or the slot or the split end. And splitting the players out isn't necessarily going to be an unbelievable help on that level. So the RSP, and like other independent draft analysts, they're going to have one kind of grading system that fits all. And basically what I've kind of seen with my system is that it favors, for the wide receiver position, versatility. The RSP criteria, I think, slightly favors that in its positional grading. And you can see that when you look at the slot receiver, the old slot receiver role, not guys who were like Tyreek Hill who can go deep on you, but guys like Wes Welker who weren't going to get deep but get a high volume of catches. Those types of players would get pushed down on my board a little bit lower. The Jarvis Landrys would get pushed down a little bit because they didn't have that factor to be able to separate and win on the outside, you know, in the deepest ranges of the field on a consistent basis. So that would drop them down a little bit. So, you know, guys that would tend to be raised up a little bit more are more like Hakeem Butler. And that's why, you know, I wrote about this in the Hakeem Butler chapter. You know, the difference between Hakeem Butler and DK Metcalf, and the reason that I have Butler higher, is the fact that Butler can play all three positions. He can play in the slot. He runs, and he can run the type of routes that fit pretty much anywhere on the field. Whereas DK Metcalf, there's a little more debate about whether he can do that. He's more of a classic split end who you're going to see running deep routes that are more straight line and angular and breaks in terms of, you know, 45 degree angles in terms of his breaks, like post routes, corner routes. You can see go routes, and then you'll see occasionally routes that break back to the quarterback. But usually when there's a lot of separation or a lot of cushion given by the defenders who are covering him. And, you know, that's one of the things that, you know, we could get into a little bit more. I mean, I'll go off on this tangent real quick, is that, you know, I saw Brad Kelly, who's at the Draft Network, who who studies wide receivers. And Brad, I think, was a high school receiver coach. He still may be, played a little bit in college at a small school. And Brad, you know, Brad does good work. And one of the things that I saw Brad in terms of an interaction he had this past week was about DK Metcalf. I think he has Metcalf number one on his board. And somebody asked him, are you concerned about DK Metcalf's 20 shuttle and his three cone drill because it's slow and that may translate to him having trouble being able to drop his weight and bend his hips and change direction? And Brad's response to this man was to ask a question with a question. And it was, where have you seen this type of issue hurt DK Metcalf on the field? And so the reader, from what it looked like at the time, really didn't have an answer for him. And I think that when you look at DK Metcalf overall on a broad level, I think Brad's right to ask that question. I happen to have an answer for it, and it may not turn out to be the right answer, but I think that it's a compelling answer and makes a compelling argument that differentiates where Brad and I are on this particular player. We both have him ranked very high. I mean, if I could pick DK Metcalf in the early round, in the first round or this early second round, and get him as my split end, I'd be thrilled. I think he's going to be a really good player. So we're talking about minutia here, but the minutia that I would show that's a little bit different, nuance, comes down to projection. Brad's answer to that question, while I haven't asked him directly, but what I would say is, if I were to make the guess, is that his answer to that question is, there isn't an issue in Brad's opinion that this slow 20 shuttle and slow three cone drill is really going to impact him. And that when you look at what he's seen on the college tape, he hasn't seen enough to be convinced that it's going to impact DK Metcalf. Now, where I differ is that I think there have been isolated incidents on his college tape where, when he's covered tightly, defenders are able to have their way with him because he cannot make some of those sudden stops and breaks back to the ball with as much acceleration and deceleration as he needs to be able to do that at the pro level. So what he's projecting is what you're currently seeing is what you're going to see in the NFL. What I'm projecting is that what you're seeing right now is the result of bigger cushions by cornerbacks and other defensive backs who are scared to get beat deep by DK Metcalf on a regular basis. So they give up a lot of cushion, and that means that when he breaks back to the quarterback on certain routes like curls and hooks and comebackers and things like that, that he's getting the benefit of a deeper cushion. So it's allowing him and his slower movement with his acceleration or his deceleration and reacceleration, it's allowing that movement to be slower and him getting away with it, where I don't think he's going to get away with it as often in the NFL. Now, I don't think he's going to get totally shut down because of this, but there will be certain players who will be able to totally shut him down because of it. So it's going to be less consistent for him until he can develop a little bit better bend, if he can at all. And if he can't, he's just going to have to play around his weaknesses, which I think he can do. He's strong enough. He's fast enough. You know, he's going to be able to create runways using his physicality. There are going to be certain players that may be able to say, you know what, it's not going to work, and I'm going to be able to shut you down here and there with that, or make it a battle, and it's going to be a tougher battle for him to win that he can still do. But he'll have a little tougher time. He'll have to figure out ways to overcome that. And I think that's where I'm at with DK Metcalf, in a way where Brad may be a little bit different. But the point is that DK Metcalf on my board is a little more specialized to what he does. So he's not quite as high up on my board as someone like Hakeem Butler, who basically physically, technically, I think can do more at this stage of his game. So I hope that answers that first question when it comes to, or kind of completes that idea of why are wide receivers have so much variation. And then maybe also answers why Hakeem Butler is also at the top of my board. Another question that I was asked was about fumble rates. Because one of the things that I explained in my in the RSP about fumble rates is that I borrowed a formula and really built on it a little bit more on something that Dane Brugler at The Athletic did when he was at CBS. And one of the things that Dane did was he had done an annual article on fumble rates when he worked at CBS, where he based it on tiers on the average fumble rates of the top 10 NFL rushers during that prior year. And I thought it was a good idea, and it was something off to a good start. And I built on it because I felt the criteria could be fleshed out into detail with greater context and meaning. So, you know, what I said was, you know, if you look at Dane Brugler's top 10 rushers from the previous year and segmented them into tiers and into the ranges of 25 care, you know, tiers of like the way that he ranged out, which is, I think, by tiers of 25 carries. That seemed kind of arbitrary for me. So I thought maybe if I could structure it by taking the 32 teams in the NFL, creating four tiers of eight players apiece, and then examining the players with the highest workloads. And I saw that most of the lead feature backs were in the top 24. And so I decided that I would create analysis around the top 24 instead of the top 10. And then when I examined the average fumble rates for the top four producers, I saw that they averaged a fumble every 86 carries, which I think is a figure that was below average for the rate according to Brugler's tiers. But when I started to look at the expectations for fumbling based on the most productive backs, which is what Dane was doing, I realized that the results would set the expectation that elite backs fumble a lot more. So I thought it made more sense to rank the top 24 producers by fumble rates and not by their production. And Dane was going by production. And I think if you look at fumble rates, that's what you're trying to isolate there. So it's good to determine the average fumble rates by starting running backs, but by using production in that way was a little bit more problematic. And what I was asked was, well, why is it that elite backs fumble a lot more? Because wouldn't it be something that if they fumbled so much that they would lose their jobs and not remain elite? And I think the answer is it comes down to, again, fumble rates, which is that a player may fumble more in volume because he gets the ball more often, but the rate in which he does, he still has a high level of efficiency. You know, again, looking at the actual fumble rate is, you know, rate per touch, number of fumbles per touch, as opposed to total number of fumbles is a better way to go about that when you're looking at just efficiency with ball security. So that's another question that was kind of, that came up. And the third question that then we'll get on to some of these players that we're going to talk about was, when I grade players from non-Power 5 schools, and I highlight their skills and their athletic ability, how do I account for the difference in athletic ability from opponents? That was something that one of my editors asked me. And it came up when they were reading, proofing something that I wrote about Bruce Anderson, the North Dakota State running back. Well, I think the first thing that comes to mind is that a lot of these players do play Power 5 schools. They may not play them every week, but they play them often enough, usually throughout their career, that you can get a chance to see them against some of the best athletes in college football who have NFL caliber athletic ability. So there's that, you know. But, you know, that does still, what they're asking really, the root of their question is, what happens when you grade players who never get the chance to face top athletes in the college game who may have NFL athletic ability? How do you know they're really that athletic? How do you know they really have these skills? And I think the answer really comes down to this, is that if you define your criteria well for what you're looking for out of a player, and you define it to a standard of what you see NFL athletes do and NFL technicians do, the more defined you are about what you're looking for, the more likely that player's execution of if it's on the level you're looking for, will transcend their non-Power 5 program and transcend the college game and fit well for the pro game. not all the time, but I think enough that if you're really grading with that level of detail, that it will happen, that you'll see those types of things. And I've had that experience that you'll tend to, if you grade it well enough, clear enough, you define everything clearly enough, and you really have honed in on what those techniques are and how they should be applied, they transcend the level of talent, you know? So that's what, you know, a good example of that is pad level. You know, if you have good pad level, you can face someone who, you can be running towards someone who's 300 pounds or, you know, and really fast and really quick, or running someone who's 280 and not so fast and not so quick. But if you understand how to run with the right pad level, you're going to be able to get under them. You're going to be able to bounce off them. You're going to be able to work through them and get a push. And those types of things tend to be helpful enough. You know, you may not get a 5-yard push against a 300-pound guy who's the next PJ Raji, okay? But at the same time, you're going to be able to show enough that projects well to say, yeah, he's got enough strength that he was able to stalemate this guy, you know, and he was able to show good pad level through, you know, in terms of other collisions with linebackers or with safeties, and what he was able to do against them with the similar consistency of movement and technique, you can see how that was actually going to translate. So that's my answer for that one. Let's move on to some of these players. Talk about players who, you know, let's start with guys who I think are underachieving a little bit. Players who I think should be better than what they really are. And I think the first one who really comes to mind to me as one of those guys is Dillon Mitchell. You know, when I watch Dillon Mitchell, I see a guy who has excellent quickness, skill after the catch. I've watched him in the red zone just make multiple people miss with really efficient moves and get downhill and score in traffic. I mean, against linebackers and safeties in the teeth of the defense, and just make them look foolish. And I mean, in very efficient style, just dispatched with them. He can catch the ball. He can make some really nice plays deep, but he drops a lot of passes. And it's usually due to technique. Either he's not getting his hands up in the correct position. He's either getting them up in the correct position, but not getting them close enough together. Or he's having concentration drops, you know, focus drops. And one of the issues with that is that, according to Lance Zierlein, when I started doing some cross-checking of some players that I do, I looked at some of Lance Zierlein's work, and I saw Lance mention that an NFL scout, that some NFL scouts have talked about Mitchell, and that he has a reputation for not being a worker, that he doesn't go to the weight room, he doesn't work the jugs machine. And so there's concern about that, because when you have a guy who wants to be a professional wide receiver and he's not working at his craft where his craft has weaknesses, then that's a big red flag for a player. Now, let's just kind of talk about this let's kind of stretch out on this one for a minute and say, hypothetically, there could be a lot of reasons why Dillon Mitchell isn't working right now, and he might end up working once he gets into the NFL. One of those things might be that maybe he's focused so much on academics that he's prioritizing his time to finish up academically to make sure that he graduates, and he's not able to put in that extra time. And what he's doing has been good enough for the team for him to be a starting receiver, so he's not worrying about it as much. That's a plausible possibility. Whether people like that or not, that's plausible. He could come into a camp and start working at all of this and, you know, approach it with a priority that he approached to schoolwork. And there you have it. Now, I don't know if Dillon Mitchell is that great of a student or not. Okay. I'm just taking it as a hypothetical. He could be having family drama. You know, he could be having something going on in his life where, you know, a lot of the energy that he has away from the tasks at hand that he has to complete as a requirement of school and a requirement of athletics, the rest of the time, maybe he's having to communicate with people who are not, you know, on campus, and he has to, you know, and he's worried about some of those things, and he's got to deal with some of those things, you know, in the best way that he can from a distance. And maybe that takes up a lot of his time. You know, maybe that's going on. He could also just be having fun being a, you know, being a college player and being a college student. And maybe he's not really taking it seriously. And you can understand why there might be a red flag with that too. But because, you know, certainly the NFL expects players to take this stuff very seriously and show a level of maturity that's above and beyond most college students. So maybe Mitchell's being like, you know, a typical college student and just having fun, you know, and what he's doing is good enough. That's possible too, you know, but whatever the reason is, he's going to have to prove that he's willing to work. And so far he hasn't proven that. So you're going to see him probably, you know, drop down and not be a high pick or as high of a pick that he could be. But I'm telling you, if this guy addresses his conditioning, gets stronger, works on his hands so that they're more consistent, there's reason why fans who are on YouTube are making videos comparing him to Odell Beckham Jr. Now, it doesn't mean that he's as talented as Odell Beckham Jr., but he has some of those traits that are similar. And you can see that if he puts it all together and the drops are shored up and he becomes a little stronger, this is going to be a good player in the NFL if he works on his game. So he's definitely a player that leads this list of somebody who should be better than what he is right now. I think Antoine Wesley, another wide receiver, fits that. When you look at him, he's out of Texas Tech, 6'4", 206. I think he has the skills to become a meaningful contributor. But I think the bigger question is, can he become a starter? Because I think there's part of his game that really show that promise. He's someone that if you took like Josh Reynolds and Keenan Allen and blended them together, you'd probably get someone like Wesley. He's not very fast, but he's quick. He's lanky. He uses his size to his advantage. I think he's someone that has a lot of good release moves. But at the same time, I think patient and athletic cornerbacks have an easier time being able to manhandle him. They often can pin him to the sideline. And because he's not very fast, he's someone that, you know, once he's about 30, 40 yards downfield and running, defenders catch up to him or he's unable to separate at all, you know, throughout the route. So you're going to see him more as a red zone guy, maybe a slot guy, even though he's not really considered a slot guy all the time. But I think he's sudden enough to be able to become a slot player. The problems that I have with him is that he just lacks the requisite flatness of breaks. He does a lot of things inconsistently. Some of it is breaks. He's not always flat enough with his breaks or executes the hard breaks as well as he should. Or there's always something missing with his routes where he's missing some element that doesn't tie the whole route together. I think he's better at longer stemmed routes, you know, with angular breaks, you know, corner routes, the burst corner route, the post route, things like that. He tends to be a little bit better at. But, you know, hard breaking routes or routes he has to tell a bit of a story, I think that he's a guy that misses a key detail in the story when he tries to tell one. And basically it allows defenders to basically guess the ending. So same thing with his, you know, his hands. You know, I think he has good enough hands to develop into a consistent pass catcher, but he doesn't always consistently use the correct techniques for the location of the target. And he has some untimely drops. And I think he's really inconsistent with using his hands when the targets are arriving above his waist and using the correct hands position. So he has to attack it a little bit better. And I felt like that, you know, I didn't feel like I saw him struggle against a higher level of opponent when he was in these types of situations. So he's got to do better when he's attacking, you know, from the running the fade route or the back shoulder fade or the post. And he got away with it some in the college game. But I don't think he's going to get away with it as much in the pros. So that's a player who I'm a little bit more concerned about in terms of, you know, what he has to offer and that he could be a better player than he is. Another one's Travis Homer, you know, the running back out of Miami. I think he can be a contributor right now. And in an offense that uses him a lot as a receiver, he might even be able to earn starter numbers for people who are interested in fantasy football. He might be able to do that sooner than later. I love the intensity which he plays with, but I don't think he plays smart. I don't think he is technically sound, and he needs to get better from that perspective in order to become a meaningful starter. And I think examples of that that come into play is that, you know, when you watch him, his pad level, you know, is good enough in terms of being able to break some tackles, but he's not a highly powerful back. I think he often lacks the build up momentum to generate a push when it comes to finishing plays. So he's got to do better with that. And one of the things that he can do better is that he has to keep his head up when he works into contact. You can't drop your head when you work into contact, because if you do that, you're going to go down right away. The way that your neck bends and your back is shaped when you drop your head, you're basically going to fall down without getting yards through that contact. So he's going to have to keep his head up, and that's going to be a tough fix for him. I'm concerned about that. A guy like Tevin Coleman has those issues a little bit. And even though you see him earn some yards after contact that are favorable, it's often because of momentum-generated speed where he's had a long runway to hit somebody. And we're not talking about yards through contact, what I've often referred to with that. You know, I think also one of the things that he can do a little bit better at is he's better at running gap than zone. I don't think he has a really good connection between what his eyes see and his feet do. And so you want to see him, you know, split smaller creases a little bit more. You know, and I think he's better at running plays where he knows he just has one gap to hit. And when he does that, he can be the crease splitter on those small gap plays, you know, where there's not a lot of separation between linemen there. But it's one of those things that I just don't know if he's a guy who, you know, from that power standpoint, from the pad level standpoint, whether or not that's going to be something that he's going to fix easily. And then even with his hands, I mean, he's got great hand-eye coordination. He catches the ball really well, but I don't think he's consistent with using the correct hands technique right now. And so he has some occasional errors on his tape where he didn't get his head around fast enough, where he didn't use the correct hand position all the time. And he's going to have to develop more as a route runner. So, and then when it comes to pass protection, that's also going to be an issue for him, because as good as he is as a receiver and as fast as he is, you need someone who can pick up blitzes. And I think that what happens sometimes is he doesn't trust his lateral movement well enough when he has to slide across a gap to handle a delayed blitz or any kind of pressure that breaks through. And as a result, you know, he'll kind of panic a bit and end up trying to lean towards the defender to make any kind of contact rather than slide and be balanced when he makes that hit. So when he's trusting his movement, he looks good. When he doesn't trust it or doesn't feel like he's recognized the blitz in time to get over there, the leaning that he does tends to be worse. You know, it tends to be a tough situation. He makes things a little worse. So Travis Homer, that's another one who, you know, I think could be better than what he is, but it may be a little more difficult than, say, Dylan Mitchell and Antoine Wesley. We'll see. The fourth guy is a guy that I think a lot of people like, and that's Alex Barnes out of Kansas State. And there's a lot I like about him, but when you watch him, one of the things that really just kind of puzzles me is that when you see him break through the first level and get to the second level, you don't see him really aggressive or run hard in terms of finishing. Now, this is different than defenders like defensive tackles who are running him down and they hit him in the side from backside pursuit and they bounce off him. That's awesome to watch, and Barnes is definitely has that high level balance that I like. But when he sees defenders in the open field or coming downhill at him and hit him, you see him kind of go down pretty easily. He doesn't attack. He doesn't respond into it. He almost kind of leans away from the contact. And when he's leaning away, he gives up his balance and takes the hit. So, you know, when it comes to Barnes, I don't see him, you know, finishing on that level that he needs to. And while I like his footwork in a lot of situations, he can make some really nice cuts. He just hasn't really pieced his total game together at a level that's befitting of his physical ability. And part of that is that finishing skill. There's a few other things, but the finishing skill is really probably the strongest issue in his game that I think could be better when we talk about him. So, you know, I think that he's a guy that people are going to really find, you know, intriguing, but he's going to have to really sustain that acceleration that he has and build on it. And I don't think he really does that either. So it's kind of like the acceleration's good, but the speed isn't great. The finishing isn't strong. And I just want to see a player who uses his strength a little bit more than what we have at what I've seen at this stage. So, and I also kind of think that, you know, when you look at him, he's someone that, how would I best put this? I think he's more of a jack of all trades guy. I don't see him as being a special starter at this stage. So I hope I'm wrong with that, but it's just something that I'm not seeing, and you know, I'm just not seeing enough from him overall. Let's talk about some guys who I think are under the radar prospects, players who I think have a lot to offer, that maybe are just one to two improvements away from becoming really good. And maybe they're, you know, maybe this is the opposite side of the same coin of what we just talked about. But one of the guys that I really like that no one's really talking about much is John Hilleman, former Boston College running back, 6 feet, 222 pounds, played at Rutgers to finish the year. And this is a really skilled cutback runner. I think he's really good on plays that, you know, stretch plays to the tackler end. He's very good at cutting back against penetration. He has a footwork to weave around defenders well. This is a guy that ran, you know, a sub 4.440. You know, when we talk about Alex Hilleman, let me see exactly what he ran. Hilleman ran, you're probably going to guess it before I even get to it at this stage, but here we go. 4.4440. That's pretty good. For 222, yeah, 4.4440, 4.2720 shuttle. That's starter caliber. That's like in the range of, you know, some of the better big backs we've seen in the past couple of years. 7.12, you know, three cone drill, still very good. 20 reps on the bench press. Strong dude, 35 inch vertical, starter level vertical. Strong legs, strong upper body, good burst. Quick enough change of direction, very good long speed. And he's a smart runner. I think he understands the difference between what he's capable of and the reality of the situation. So when the reality of the situation is that a crease is closing, you're going to see him leave his feet to try and bleed every yard that he can get out of the situation. But he's also someone that, as we saw, he can accelerate well through cuts. He can bend downhill well. He kind of has some of that run bending, curvy linear ability for a big back. He's patient. I think he baits defenders pretty well. You know, he's someone that also I think understands how to generate scrums when he has to just hit a crease and push. So the big things for me are, can he fix his ball security? His fumble rate's 1 per 102 touches. It's in the committee tier right now. He's got to tighten the elbow a little bit. If he can do that and become a better ball security guy, he probably would be closer to my top 10 right now. And then the same thing goes when we start talking about his ability to pass protect. You know, when you look at that, I think that if he's able to pass protect a little bit better, you're going to see his he would probably be higher on my list at this stage already. And he just has to be, he's better at cutting defenders on interior blitzes than he is other plays. When he play cuts outside, he's a little bit too low. He's going to have to develop a better punch when in terms of stand up blocking. And if he can do these two things, he'd be a top 10 back on my board already right now. And he kind of reminds me of a player like Ontario Smith, who, though Smith was a little bit more agile in terms of his footwork and his ability to make cuts, Hilleman is an intriguing guy. So don't be surprised if Hilleman really makes an impact in camp this year with the team. He's someone that's, when you see that kind of speed and the kind of skills he's had, also the injury, you know, he had a major foot injury that cost him some time, and he was really off to a good start at Boston College, and it took him over a year to really get healthy. So those three things really kind of dropped him on my board. Otherwise, he might have been, you know, a guy that we would talk about as a sleeper in the top 10. Demarie Crockett. And when we look at Demarie Crockett, he also has a contributor score. And I think he's an intriguing player because one of the things that I wrote about him was if his speed and acceleration translate to the starter thresholds and he plays to the best of his ability, he's no worse than a rotational starter, meaning he's a guy that could start right away for a team. They just may have to take him out in certain situations, but he could get a reasonably high workload as a committee back right now. That's the kind of talent he has if the speed and acceleration were there. Some games, some years, I saw a quicker guy. Some games, I saw a more plodding player. Then we saw him at the combine. Or not the combine, but at his pro day. Pro day, he ran a 4.440, 37-inch vertical leap. That's the kind of explosion that you want to see. And I remember watching him against South Carolina and seeing him beat cornerbacks with ankles on him. And I thought, that's interesting. I wonder, it was kind of isolated situation, but it was interesting to watch this 5'11", 225-pound back win like that. You know, and what I saw is this was a guy who can run gap and zone. He was really good on off-tackle zone and counter. I thought he was patient, but maybe against penetration, he could be a little bit better with his reads there. He was someone that he needed to get a little bit better with his footwork choices, where it'd be better if he dipped on a certain type of play rather than tried to spin. And then also sometimes he'd try to veer from the path of the play, trying to create something bigger and wind up with less than what the original plan was. But, you know, you could see other things that were really promising. He could cut his stride length to adjust to the developing blocks. He has really good ankle flexion to make sharp cuts. He can jump stop. He can jump cut. I think that for his weight, he really did a pretty good job making cuts, though I thought he could eliminate some extra steps from those cuts to get downhill a little bit easier. He's obviously strong enough. I thought he did a very good job of getting his pads low and to be able to push linebackers. And I thought he did a good job of being able to, pull through wraps, even defensive tackles, penetrating against him. He could pull through those wraps, and oftentimes he could get 3 to 4 yards, through contact and push a pile well. So he got a strong, fast runner. He's got to get better as a blocker. That's probably one of the biggest issues that he has. And he's someone that what I didn't see, what one of the things that kind of concerned me was effort. And I think the issue for him was that he didn't get along with Coach Derek Dooley, the new offensive coordinator from Missouri. And so he seemed to lose his edge, maybe his motivation and effort to play at the level he should have when he was, later in his career, as opposed to what he did earlier. But if it's something that teams feel good about, that him moving forward, and they don't think that it's going to be a maturity issue and that he's going to have more of these problems, I think DeMarre Crockett could be a real find for a team. You know, and on a what's seen as a lackluster running back class for many, DeMarre Crockett's an intriguing guy in the same way that John Hilliman's an intriguing guy. Two big backs with speed, with good quickness, who show pretty good power. Those are guys that, you know, if they're undrafted free agents or late round picks, you want to keep an eye on them a little bit to see if what they're showing in camp stays consistent throughout camp, throughout the preseason, and you might have something there. Another guy is Kareth White. This is a guy who was the understudy to Devin Singletary. And White ran a 4.36 40. He's 5'10", 210 pounds, and had a 42-inch vertical leap and 21 reps on the bench press. Strong, explosive, speedy. And he's someone that you can see the angular cutting ability with him. You know, I think he's has a little more style similar to Deion Lewis in extent. He only needs a step or two to transition downhill when he's working towards the sideline, you know, maybe on an outside run. He can take those one or two steps to transition quickly downhill. I think he does a really good job with stop-start quickness to avoid run blitzes that get into the backfield. He also has that curvy linear speed to bend around pursuit without losing a lot of his pace. And so he can avoid you not with just stop, start, or hard cuts, but also that curvy linear movement. So it makes him versatile in making people miss and winning angles, especially using his speed to his maximum ability. I think he has enough balance to work off indirect contact to his core when hit to his core by outside linebackers, and even direct hits by safeties. So he's good at being able to get through contact to enough of a degree that I think he'll be helpful in the NFL. He has good high and tight ball carriage a lot of the time, but he's going to have to work on maybe when he makes dramatic moves to keep that ball a little bit tighter than he has right now. I think his receiving skill looks like it could be really good. We're just going to need to see a little bit more of it. But if he can prove that he's a reliable receiver, he can improve his pass protection. I think this is a guy with big play upside who could emerge into something more than just a reserve. He might actually be a contributor right now. I have him graded as a contributor, someone who could give starter execution in a limited role. He might be able to become a lead back. Maybe he could, if he gains a little bit more weight, gains about 10 pounds, maintains that speed, maybe even builds on it, you might see a starter. You know, so he has that kind of ability. It's kind of interesting. Another interesting guy to me is Wesley Fields, Georgia Southern back. This is a guy who I've talked about before a little bit, but I really like his ability to cut and find the downhill crease. He's someone that ran a little bit more in a, you know, college offense with a lot of option, but imagine him maybe as a reserve who could play for Baltimore and be kind of that speed back who could take pitches and get outside, you know, and take some of those option pitches as he develops. He might be a fun play alongside Lamar Jackson. He can also catch. He can work really well downfield and make plays, you know, in the intermediate, vertical, and deep ranges of the field. Very good tracker of the football. So I think for him, it's just a matter of continuing to build on what I think he already does well, which is reading blocks at the line of scrimmage. He's just going to have to, you're just going to have to help him work and gain familiarity with more NFL-oriented run concepts than what he saw at Georgia Southern. And just like Jerick McKinnon and Matt Breda, and I think he can transition fast. So he's a player that I don't think a lot of people are talking about at all, but I think is worth watching as an undrafted free agent in the camp. And the last guy is Kadri Olison. Kadri Olison, you know, the interesting about him is I wondered if he would be quick enough. And I think his workout times show that he will be quick enough. But this is a guy that his running back coach said that Olsen was one of the smartest players he's coached in nearly 30 years, and thought that he'd make a really good coach one day. He's a special teams guy, so I think he's going to get a shot to be able to make a roster as a special teams player early on. But I like his ability to run zone and gap plays. He understands how to use his steps in terms of his stride length and pacing to be able to set up creases. He drops his weight in the transitions really well. So only needs one or two steps to go from an east-west run towards the end or tackler or around a corner and then drop his weight. And in that one or two steps, he can get downhill and accelerate through it. I think he runs through wraps to his ankles pretty well, even when he's working sideline to sideline. And that's something that bigger backs usually have an issue with. And he's 6'1", 228. So the fact that he can break some of these tackles moving east-west that, you know, a lot of teams say, listen, if you can get a big back moving east-west, you've won. Olsen, I mean, again, it's only ankle tackles, but I see this happen with pros where they get wrapped at the ankles moving, you know, east-west, and they go down. He's a little better at that than the average bear. I think he does a good job of being patient also on plays with a fullback, even though you don't see that as much in the NFL. But he you know, he's someone that can follow fullback. He flips his hips well, gives him a good opportunity to be able to bounce outside against penetration. And there's a lot of guys who, when they face penetration, take too many steps, or they may take a big step towards the line of scrimmage trying to make a dramatic move. And Olsen's really efficient. He does a really good job of being able to flip his hips and get away without taking too many extra steps. He has a good head fake, good jump cut. I like what I saw with some speed to beat defensive ends and linebackers and even cornerbacks up the sideline for some long touchdowns this year. And so, you know, 4.58 speed isn't anything to write home about for most backs, but it's good enough, you know, for him to be able to win. I mean, Nick Chubb had a 4.57 40, and I believe that's correct. And you can see that, you know, Olsen has the quickness of a back who's going to be able to get up to speed and threaten the secondary on a regular basis. So you can add that to, you know, 4.31, that's Travis Homer's, you know, shuttle time, 20 shuttle time. That's good acceleration. 7.02 three cone drill. That's also starter level change of direction skill. So this is a guy who, you know, he can break tackles. I think he diagnoses blitzes well. I think he's someone that catches the ball even with contact looming. I think that he could succeed as more than a backup. And if he does, it's going to be because his movements are precise and quick enough to do the job. I think he has that kind of underrated quickness in a way that we saw a back like Arian Foster have that underrated quickness. So keep an eye on Olsen. As a matter of fact, keep an eye on Olsen, Wesley Fields, Kareth White Jr., Demarie Crockett, and John Hilleman. Those are guys that aren't really high on my board, as high as they could be, but I recognize that they could end up outperforming where they are at this stage. And then guys like Mitchell, Wesley, Travis Homer, Alex Barnes, those are guys that I think could be better than what they are right now. So hopefully you enjoyed this RSP cast. If you enjoy this or any other ones that I've done in the past, and, you know, please go ahead and rate and review this podcast for me, or you can email me and let me know what you thought of it. And of course, you can get the RSP publication, which is available now. And again, what you get with the RSP is also the post draft that comes out no later than a week after the NFL draft. And you're put on my list for my newsletter that comes out monthly from June through December. That includes rankings updates three times during the year of 3 years worth of draft classes. So I profile for this year, I'll profile the 2017 class, the 2018 class, and 2019 class, giving updates to what I think of where they're ranked after the draft, after sometime during preseason, and sometime later in the year, like around November. So check that out. You can get the RSP at mattwaldman.com. Thanks again for listening. Have a good Monday.